And I was fascinated by this six-year-old girl who had really internalized or embodied all of the proscriptions of her parents. Don't talk. Don't tell anybody about us. Behave. And those sorts of things. To the point where the girl was mute.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. You're listening to Into the Fold, the Hogg Foundation podcast. The Hogg Foundation is a mental health grant-making foundation and part of the University of Texas at Austin. To learn about the history of the Hogg Foundation as well as our grant programs, visit www.hogg.utexas.edu. And Hogg is spelled H-O-double-G. With us today is Dr. Louise Zayas, Dean of UT Austin's School of Social Work. He is here with us to discuss a recent study which he co-authored that examines levels of anxiety and depression among the U.S.-born children of the undocumented, and in particular, psychosocial stresses such as, you know, the looming threat of deportation and the impact that that can have on the emotional well-being of youngsters who are thus affected. So Dr. Zayas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ike. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so let's start by just getting an overview of your professional background and how it is that that this particular issue became especially salient for you.
Well, thank you. Yes, I can be very brief about my background. My training is in social work and in psychology, both clinical social work and developmental or child psychology. And I've been interested in minority populations throughout my career and have worked in low-income settings, urban settings for just about the entire time, as well as working in academia, of course, teaching and doing research. And so I've always had an interest in what happens to marginalized, disenfranchised communities, especially the children in those communities. And over the years, actually starting in 2005, about 10 years ago, I was called by some attorneys to come and evaluate a little girl whose father was in deportation hearings, except that he was challenging the removal, as deportation is called. So it's a cancellation of removal case. And I was fascinated by this six-year-old girl who had really internalized or embodied all of the proscriptions of her parents. Don't talk. Don't tell anybody about us. Behave. And those sorts of things. To the point where the girl was mute. She would not talk to anyone at school. She didn't talk at school for nearly a year, both pre-K and kindergarten, and would sometimes withdraw in class. But at home, she spoke with her parents, played with her siblings. There was no speech problem, no language problem. It was a case of selective mutism. And when I dug deeper into what was going on, it was really her attempt to keep the family secret that her parents were undocumented immigrants. And with that one case grew this increasing interest in what happens to the children of undocumented immigrants who are U.S. citizens. The children are U.S. citizens. And what happens to them in these cases of deportation. And so that's where my interest grew. And after that, I did many, many cases that in which I testified, evaluated first the child, then testified in immigration court on the family's behalf, and we had a succession of wins or victories where the families were able to stay in the United States. And that was when I began to continue this work.
Okay, I want to say a little bit more about this selective mutism. And one question that immediately springs to my mind is, if you're a psychologist and you're trying to establish any kind of a rapport, what kinds of challenges can a situation like that present where, you know, you're trying to, to create an atmosphere of safety disclosure, all the while giving the child reason to think that you're an ally or even just neutral.
Okay. Well, it was, she knew coming into the interview or the series of interviews, because it was about four or five times that I met with her, she knew that her parents trusted me. So there was an element of this transferred trust. Her parents had told her, speak with this man, this psychologist, social worker, and tell him what you can. It didn't operate so easily. They told her, but she didn't come, you know, speak willingly. So we began to use drawings as a way of understanding what she was experiencing. And we played a little bit. But in the drawings, it was interesting because she would draw a very happy family, a house with windows and curtains in the windows and flower boxes, a dog outside in a doghouse in the yard, and a lovely picture of a nice family. And in the drawings, she would always place herself close to her father. So whether that closeness extended from before the deportation hearings began or was as a result of that shock of being arrested and then detained and then enter the judicial system, we don't know, but it really doesn't matter. The point is she was demonstrating how close she was to her father. Over time, she began to trust me more, and then she would utter some words. But a lot of it was yes, no, my formulating questions and trying to make sure that I didn't lead her, but give her a chance to say yes or no, shake her head, and then perhaps give some open-ended questions that would allow her to say one or two words that would answer my questions.
Mm-hmm. How long ago was this?
This case was in 2006. Okay. That was by far the hardest case I had. After that, most of the kids spoke and could do the drawings, could undergo the testing that I did. So I would use depression measures, trauma measures, self-concept measures, behavioral measures that the parents filled out, depending on the age of the child, whether the parent would complete the forms or the child would complete the forms, and then the clinical interview, just learning more about the child and their life experiences. And so this one case of selective mutism was the only one that I really had and the most challenging. The others, I had children who were talkative and engaged.
Okay. But, I mean, if there's a silver lining, I'm sure that you may have, you know, learned at least a thing or two that has helped you subsequently as a psychologist or researcher, I would think.
Oh, I've learned a great deal from these children and their families. And it was that learning that deepened my empathy for what it must be like to live every day under the shadow of deportability, right? We found in our research, for example, that parents taught the kids two rules early on. Now, rules that you and I might find common in the average family, two rules, but they were differently applied in this case. Rule number one was, don't talk, be quiet. Not in the be quiet and sit in your chair. It's don't talk to anybody about our circumstances of being undocumented. So children lived with that rule all the time. The other rule was sit still, don't move. More so in public. So they were not to talk to people at school or elsewhere and reveal any of the family's secrets about their legal status. But there was also the situation in public where they had to behave so that they did not draw attention to themselves. So we would hear kids say, for example, as one boy did, telling us that he wondered why his parents were always so vigilant on the highways looking for police, both his mother in the passenger seat and his dad driving, wondering, there's one there, there's a cop there, there's a police car coming up, slow down. And he wondered why they were so anxious. And when he asked them, they said to him, it's because we're undocumented. And then he began to understand why sometimes parents would panic and say to him, sit still, don't talk, because there would be a police nearby. Or in the case of a little girl who described that her father shifted lanes at a traffic light, and she didn't understand why he needed to shift lane. And he told her that alongside had come a Customs and Border Patrol van, and that They were to sit still, not look over and make eye contact with them, to just sit in the car looking forward so that they wouldn't draw attention from the Customs and Border Patrol. That's the kind of be quiet, sit still that goes beyond what our parents taught us, be quiet, you know, sit still, but a very different one, because here the child holds in his or her hands the family's future or possible, you know, possible debacle if they don't do the right thing, or if they fail to do the right thing.
Okay, so following up on that, this recent study that you co-authored, published, I believe, in the Journal of Child and Family Studies.
That's correct.
If you may, just give us an overview, the study's design, and its most significant findings.
Okay. Well, it's very. It was perhaps easy to describe. We had three groups of children. Two of the groups had children, had parents who had been deported. One of those groups had left the U.S. with their parents when their parents were deported to Mexico. That was about 25 or so children, and you'll have to forgive me, I don't have the numbers, exact numbers in front of me. We also had another group of children whose parents were deported or in the process of deportation, but were in the United States still. And then we took a third group, a group of average, if you will, children, U.S. citizen children of undocumented immigrants who were under no deportation proceedings. And so we took samples from, We took instruments and measured the children on the same variables or areas, depression primarily, behavior, anxiety, and trauma. And what we found was that the children who were whose parents were in deportation proceedings or had been deported but had remained in the United States, the kids we called the orphans because they were orphaned, in effect, by the parents' loss, is that they suffered a great deal of anxiety. That was their anxiety levels were high, and there was an awful lot of negative self-esteem, as if the loss of the parent had made them feel less and less worthy or valuable. The children who we interviewed in Mexico who had moved with their parents, so they had not lost their parents, they had lost their place, if you will, were more likely to show depression. They measured higher on depression, they tended to have sadder moods and show more physical symptoms of depression, the kind of things that we might hear kids tell us, headaches, stomach aches, pains and aches and that sort of thing. What we did see in all three sets of children, including the U.S. citizen children who were not in any deportation proceeding, is that they all were very anxious children, over vigilant, constantly alert to what might happen to their parents, worried that will mommy or daddy get home today from work without being stopped by the police and perhaps arrested and detained. So they were all very anxious. One of the things we found about the children in the U.S. who were under no deportation proceedings, that is, their parents weren't, was that these kids were more average in many ways. They had positive self-concept, they thought well of themselves, so in many ways they were healthy, but that didn't stop them from being anxious about the potential deportation of their parents.
These days in the behavioral health field, you know, we hear an awful lot about eliminating disparities and also about the social determinants of health. And immigration status is certainly one of those. But I wonder, you know, just exactly how much good research there is on the particular issue of the psychological effects of deportation proceedings. Or is that, at this point, still, you know, an emerging field of study?
It is certainly an emerging field, and very little has been done to date. Ours was among one of the few studies that was conducted with a larger size sample that was funded by the National Institutes of Health, which is the body that funds much of the top research in this country. It's hard to really do research in this area. First of all, we don't know how many children have left the country or have been left behind. There's simply no repository for that data. We do know that there are millions of people deported in the past 10 years, at least over 3 million have been deported, and roughly 1,700,000 children, U.S. citizen children, have been affected. But how many go to other countries, whether it's Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, or back to a country in Africa or a country in Asia, which are the other two places where we have deported people to? We don't know how many children there are. Consequently, we can't follow them. We can't measure, find out how they're doing psychologically. Even the ones that are left behind may be left with family who's protecting them, or older siblings taking care of them. But those children are not really accessible to us unless they self-identify, and that's very hard. So it's a tough area to study. Now, there are some ways we could, but that would take the goodwill of the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement if they were to allow us in to find out which kids, upon a deportation of a parent, which kids are going with their parents, which kids are staying behind. That would help us be able to identify those kids, engage them and their parents in the research, and find out more about the effects of deportation and the possible leaving the country or staying behind. And we can also learn more about just what it's like to be a U.S. citizen children under this cloud of deportation hanging.
Right. Okay, so, I mean, this was a fairly small study. So, I mean, if you had your way and all the resources in the world, you know, how comprehensive a study is comprehensive enough to really, you know, give you confidence that, you know, that you've truly hit upon something?
Well, I do occasionally dream about that study. Where there would be no barriers to cost or magnitude, right? That study would look at the children now, that is, while they're here, and do something prospective. That is, we can find out how are they functioning right now? So we get a baseline. And then what happens to those children upon the deportation of their parents, whether they're left behind or go to another country? So, and if we could then do more than just compare, say, those who are deported to Latin American countries, I'd like to know about those who are either exiled or orphaned when their parents are deported to Africa or to Asia, to find out what the similarities are, the differences, how cultural factors play in, how political factors play in to the children's reactions. It would be a study of tens of thousands of children, but I know I'm not going to get it anytime soon. But that would be the ideal study where we could really then follow those children over time. And then we could say to our government, you know, not only is this wrong to create these exiles and these orphans, but here's how wrong it is, because here's how much the damage is that's being done to the children. And that would be the study that I would love to do, if you can find the funding for me.
I'll get right on that immediately. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we're, as citizens of the United States, we're both accustomed to the national rhetoric on immigration and immigration reform. But one thing, having lived in Texas my whole life, that I've noticed is that at the state and local level, you know, you can find even some fairly conservative politicians, you know, who are pretty pragmatic on the subject. And so I'm just, one question that I have, I mean, I guess in your capacity as an expert, maybe consultant, somebody who's perhaps given, you know, testimony at the legislature, city councils, I mean, do you find that people across the political spectrum are fairly, you know, receptive to what you've had to say on the subject?
Well, yes, but it depends, or to an extent. We do know that polls show that most Americans agree, more than 50% of Americans agree, that we've got to do something reasonable for these many undocumented people and their U.S. citizen children, and even the undocumented. a way to allow them to stay, because we know it's unrealistic to deport 11, 12 million people. It's just simply impossible. And then because of the ties they have here, we also know that businesses will lose an important part of their workforce should we deport. So I find people receptive. Not everyone agrees that there should be a path to citizenship, but frankly, not every immigrant wants citizenship. They want a future for their children, a place where they can live and that they can work, even if they are temporary citizens, or rather temporary protected status if they're coming from a war-torn country, or if they're legal permanent residents, perhaps moving toward citizenship. But I think we can protect the children by protecting the parents. I want to add to that, there's, you know, we are one of the great legal systems of the world. We've really do a great job of due process and things like that. One of the things that I have discovered in this process of understanding what happens to children deportation is that immigration law and family law do not mesh. They actually clash. In family court, the standard is the best interest of the child. Everything is what's in the best interest of the child, whether it's adoption, foster care, divorce, custody, and things like that. What's in the best interest of the child? That governs pretty much how the family law is practiced. On the other hand, in immigration court, we have the rule of exceptional and extremely unusual hardship that has to be proven by the undocumented immigrant who's being deported. The child, the U.S. citizen child, is not considered. There is no best interest of the child in immigration court. Only we have to prove that there would be exceptional and extremely unusual hardship on the child. So it becomes an afterthought that has to be added by the immigrant's attorney. Otherwise, it will not be discussed at all. So the best interest of the child is not mentioned. And in that regard, it really clashes. The two clash. We're not thinking about the best interest of the child in immigration court the way we do in family court. And yet they're both part of this great legal system that we have.
When it comes to actually treating or working with or even talking to these youngsters, is there any sense that there are emerging best practices, or is it mainly just, you know, falling back on the tried and true?
We don't know enough about the status of the children and the effects fully to be able to then say, here's what we need to do. We do see, as I mentioned before, the depression, the sadness, the anxiety, the hopelessness. Those we do a lot with talk therapies and play therapies for children, and perhaps understanding uniquely what the experience of the child whose parents have been deported is, and then adapt our best practices for them. But we can't say that we've gotten a best practice or an evidence-based practice that's targeted towards this group. I think any therapy has to deal with a couple of things. One is the sense of guilt that children feel that their parents are deported. Little children tend to think that if something happened to daddy, it was my fault because I had a thought, or because I said, I don't like you, daddy, and something happened to him, and the child takes it in as if it's their fault. And so I did something wrong is what the child thinks. The other area is that of shame. Guilt and shame are two different emotions. And whereas guilt is I did something wrong, shame is I am bad. Something's wrong with me. And if a child is left with guilt and we don't intervene to help him or her understand, it's not your fault that daddy and mommy were deported, we may, and explain to them and get them to understand it so that they release the guilt, we may have a child who then feels that shame, something that could really last for a lifetime, because they feel that it was their fault and forever they will be shamed by it.
Okay. So, I'm out of questions, so maybe there's, you know, some grand takeaway that you might be willing to say in conclusion about everything that we've brought up.
Well, there are a couple of things that I'd like to say. One is that we cannot forget the U.S. citizens that are being affected by this immigration debate. We think about the undocumented, or we call them illegals. We think about the Dreamers. We talk about the children who are eligible for deferred action because of childhood arrival. We are now moving towards the deferred action for parental arrival that is bringing children over. But we don't talk about the U.S. citizen who's affected, because in a mixed status family, a parent may be undocumented, an older sibling may be undocumented and have no chance at DACA or be a Dreamer. And we have undocumented children who are eligible, and we have the U.S. citizen child, all potentially in one family. This is not the way families should live. And so that's important for us to think about. Don't just think about the rhetoric and the vitriol that's going on in the media about get the deport these people, whether citizenship. We've got to think about those who already have citizenship. And the other point I'd like to make is that there's a long history of immigration problems in the U.S. This is not the first time or the last. We've seen it from the late 1800s when we had the reaction against the Chinese. It's been in our long history, in our country's history for a long time. And so I don't think we should forget that. Much of what I've talked to you today is covered in my book, Forgotten Citizens, Deportation, Children, and the Making of American Exiles and Orphans, published this year by Oxford University Press. Much of this, including the research findings, are documented in that book.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. I wouldn't have wanted to leave that out. And thanks so much for all the really great information.
You're very welcome, Mike. Thank you very much.